This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
In the dense rainforests of remote Andaman and Nicobar archipelago in the Indian Ocean, loggers and bulldozers are preparing the ground for one of India's most ambitious infrastructure projects. On the Great Nicobar Island, plans for a mega port, international airport, and new township promise to transform the island, inhabited by the Champin and Nicobarese tribe, into a strategic gateway to the Indian Ocean. Through the project, the Indian government claims it will be able to control and restrict the flow of goods through the Malacca Strait, a logistical choke point similar to the Strait of Hormuz. As Piyush Sheikh Saria writes in his book, The Great Nicobar Betrayal, the project is not only going to be disastrous for the Champin and Nicobarese tribe, who are directly dependent on these forests for their livelihood, but it will also wipe out the habitat of some of the most critically endangered megafauna for whom the island is the only habitat. Even if built, the project will have to reckon with regular earthquakes and tsunamis. Yet despite all this critique and all these reports that have been published, the Indian government is going ahead with the project at full speed. It wants to use the project to position itself as a geopolitical rival to China. So in our Cities and Geopolitics mini-series so far, we have looked at nodal cities, logistical corridors, border infrastructures, and everyday geopolitics. What has been missing, however, is the puzzle of geopolitical ecology, which we would like to explore in this bonus episode, where we're joined by two excellent guests who have published a wonderful editorial on the topic and are continuing to write on this topic. So we're joined today by Garrett Grady Lovelace and Malini Ranganathan. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us, Nitin.
Yes, honored to be here.
Thank you. I think the listeners probably know your work already, but if you don't mind, it'll be nice if you could maybe just introduce yourself and maybe point to some of your work for the uninitiated listeners.
Thanks a lot. Yes, my name is Malini Ranganathan, and I am a urban geographer by training and also a political ecologist and scholar of environmental justice, focused on South Asia, in particular, the processes through which cities are developing in highly unequal ways and excluding the caste oppressed, also ethnic and racial minorities. I do work also in the United States on environmental justice, particularly around climate vulnerability in Washington, D.C. And overall, I think of myself as a traveling companion, you know, in struggles against imperialism and colonialism, especially seen in the kinds of impunity that we see in Palestine today. And so that has been a core part of my scholar activism over the last 3 years.
Yes. Thank you, Nitin. So honored to be here and to be in dialogue. I teach and research agricultural policy and agrarian geography, focusing on colonial histories and anti-colonial struggles related to land and labor and food systems. So I have a particular focus on U.S. agricultural policy and its international contexts and consequences. And that's everything from food aid to trade to commodity dumping and broader even seeds and agrobiodiversity and data and power dynamics. So I'm trained as a geographer, also have a theology background, ethics, bioethics, and do all my work community-based research. So working with and for frontline agrarian organizations and coalitions. Thank you.
Thanks, Malini. Thanks, Garrett. So just a reminder that this series is a collaboration between Urban Political Podcast, Urban Geography, and the Second Cold War Observatory. I really enjoyed, by the way, reading your editorial. It sort of brought forward some of the things that I've been thinking about, and I'm so grateful that you wrote this, please. So your editorial argues that geopolitical ecology reveals the ecological formations underpinning state-led territorial expansion, militarized security, and extractive accumulation. Could you maybe begin by explaining what geopolitical ecology means to you and why this framework feels especially urgent in the current conjuncture?
Yes, thank you for that. Maybe I'll take a round of it and then Malini can jump in. And by the way, it's been so generative and wonderful to co-think with Malini on these. I say we're both trained as critical geographers And we're in a school of international service that kind of has like a liberal internationalism front, but a very deep kind of security focus on into warmongering. So we began that essay saying, this was back in 2023, we're warning the world that the machinations of more explicit warmongering are coming. We're in DC, we're in the belly of the beast. And just thinking through how our colleagues are thinking and framing the world, it's very much US versus Iran, US versus China, US versus Russia. And this kind of war meets war on terrorism on steroids was already percolating even before the genocide, the Israeli-US genocide against Palestine, the kind of hot violence version of the slow violence got going in late 2023. I would say, as we've been wrestling with this, we're thinking of geopolitical ecology as sitting at the intersection of political ecology, which is a field that we both have deep roots in, that interrogates the root causes and consequences of environmental inequities, and critical geopolitics, which we think rejects imperial legacies at work in dominant conceptions of security and world order. So we're bridging these two, and we're really deepening that intersection, drawing on feminist and decolonial geopolitics and critical agrarian studies. So it's not just geopolitics plus ecology. We're really kind of thinking through the root causes and historical approach of decolonial thinking to unpack what's called geopolitics. We think the word geopolitics is used as a code word to hide the ecological plunder at work. So when you see a description of a conflict-prone region, that is an obfuscation, a land grab or a water grab. So it's a discursive hiding and justification of that grab. And we're at the heart of where that's happening intellectually, academically. So we wanted to kind of, you know, get the word out that even just allegedly neutral descriptions of geopolitics as ideological struggles were the cover for the grab of the land or the food or the water. But Malini, feel free to jump in.
That was really comprehensive and I think gets to the heart of the project that we're trying to do here in this sort of nascent field of geopolitical ecology. You know, there's no ready-made canon, there's no sort of large literature which one can fall back on, but one can draw, as we do, on really rich theoretical traditions, right? Particularly, you know, feminist, anti-colonial, indigenous, Black radical traditions, and thinking about how resource confiscation, land grabbing, but also multiple forms of dispossession, right, can be often at the heart of state power, right? These are not incidental to state power. They are the very mechanisms by which state power reproduces. The interesting thing about the word geopolitics is that it tends to be, as Garrett said, a mask for a wide array of things that are just taken for granted, right? So sometimes, you know, you open with that beautiful vignette on what's happening with the Great Nicobar Project. It's merely to consolidate India's geopolitical position, right, in terms of oceanic trade and commerce. And what that ends up doing is it kind of provides a gloss for political power across borders or sort of contest between states. But what it then is a gloss over, a veneer over, is the way in which ecological resources, and I'm using that in a very, very broad sense, right, to mean land resources, water resources, foodways, and other forms of, you know, ecological resources, can often be at the very fulcrum of state power. And also ecological inequities can then result from these types of long-standing contestations between states. So really, to kind of pull the veneer off of this very sort of colloquially almost used term, geopolitics, with an uncritically used term, it's not merely just international relations, right? It's deeper than that. It's a kind of production of knowledge that serves a hegemonic status quo. Right. If we even think about the categorization of the world, you know, historically, first and third world, global south, global north, even sort of this notion of the geopolitics of the Middle East, right? As if it kind of is its own little bubble happening on its own terms, or, you know, the African geopolitics, right? These processes have histories, and part of critical geopolitics is to denaturalize these taken for granted geographical imaginaries, for one. And second, to kind of really expose what is it that's really driving, you know, on par with the root causal analysis that Garrett spoke about in political ecology, what's really driving state power and consolidation of power across borders even? I would just add that and reiterate really what the description that was given earlier.
Thank you. Thanks both. In your essay, you don't focus on cities primarily. It's but the processes you processes you describe are profoundly urbanizing. So logistical corridors, extractive infrastructures, militarized redevelopment, frontier urbanization, securitized public spaces. I have a question regarding what role do cities and urbanization play within geopolitical ecology? You talked about being located in the belly of the beast, as Garrett, you called it, in DC. So I wanted to maybe understand a little more about the role of cities, perhaps.
I'll take a stab at that. And then Garrett can also broaden to think about the linkages between city and countryside and city and rural. At this point in time, in 2026, I don't think it's a coincidence that the leader of the United States, which is now not only one of the world's greatest warmongers, but is also, you know, unabashedly stealing resources from petroleum, right, to land, is a real estate magnate, right? How does Trump make his money? If you look at Trump's history, right, he was basically, and he inherited this from his father, they were sort of racist real estate dealers and brokers in New York. And he has a whole empire of Trump properties, right, on which I've written in my book, Corruption Plot, Story, the Ethics and Public of the Late Capitalist City, right, that are essentially making like windfall profits, but often through backdoor deals with right-wing political leaders and oligarchs, right, in cities around the world, including in India. So there is a particular way in which urban land and the accumulation of capital in cities, right, is really concentrated and also leaves a lot of room for machinations and really not just the consolidation of wealth in terms of literally you can make such a profit right today, right, in terms of urban land real estate, but it's also the place where which political power is consolidating. So that political economic role that urban areas play in conjunction with their sort of the ways in which they draw in other circuits and are also, you know, drawn into other circuits of trade and commerce and sort of the flow of agricultural commodities, right? The flow of stocks, right? And financial commodities as sort of theorists in critical geography and the importance of space, right? Space is really important to capital, and spatial kind of connection and the deployment of spaces. Some spaces are valued, some spaces are devalued. Thus, we have the pristine all white lilies, you know, suburb in America. And then we have the sacrifice zone where AI data centers are being built now, right? Which are Black communities. So even taking like within a region, right? The urban has this way of literally delineating and demarcating difference and value and producing value through devaluing other spaces, all right? And have that within cities, but you also have cities doing that to other areas. And so for that purpose, I think the urban comes into view as a capital generator par excellence, right? It's a sort of producer of capital and difference par excellence. And to that extent, I think it has a really important role to play in geopolitical ecology. But I think that we have to think not disconnectedly about cities, but how they're really nodes in flows of capital, right, transnationally. You know, and as a small point, like when we were writing this geopolitical ecology paper and then our follow-on piece on Palestine, right, this whole like peace plan for Gaza that has like essentially real estate sharks from the United States like circling around, you know, trying to make a bonanza from the death and destruction, like over the dead bodies of Palestinians, right, is what's going on. It's another real estate fantasy. A lot of my urban friends were saying like this is unreal, the level of like rendering and like Disneyfication that's happening through this very grotesque form of real estate capital that you see touched down in Gaza. Now, we have no idea what's going to happen with that plan, but the Riviera was a real estate fantasy first and foremost, the so-called Gaza and Riviera.
So everything Malini said, but I think going even further, the geopolitical ecology lens points to the fact that binaries are how racial capitalism profiteers. It's the food of racial capitalism. It feeds on the binaries. And so the West versus the rest, the developed versus the underdeveloped, the rural versus the urban, that is all deliberate to dichotomize urban and rural. And so guess who wins when you've dichotomized urban rural? You know, the people who are literally gentrifying both, the people who are grabbing the land, the real estate moguls in the urban, who are working hand in hand with a neo-plantation. It's the same beast. It's just a version in the rural is a plantation industrial system. which Israel is using all over the West Bank right now. And I can get to a more recent, the USDA has funded Israeli ag tech since the 70s. Hundreds of millions of dollars have funded the takeover, and they just expanded it from Israel proper to, which, you know, obviously that's a very contested term, but the current version of Israel to the West and to Golan Heights, to Syria. Now, all of the USDA funding for Israel ag tech is right in the middle of the Golan Heights, as well as all the signatories of the Abraham Accords. So what we're doing with geopolitical ecology is we're saying there is no urban without rural and vice versa. And it is so important to connect the land grabs at work in both from an economic perspective, from a, you know, spatial perspective, and from a discursive perspective, because the solidarity of urban-rural could topple this. So as long as urban and rural are pitted against each other and classified as binaries, then the same forces that are capturing value in both will proceed, you know, unabated. Also, there is like a lingering anti-agrarian or a denigration of agrarian realms in scholarship in the sector that I'm in academia. And so even critical scholarship, critical geography, critical political ecology, oftentimes favors or centralizes the power dynamics at work in cities and in urban places and sidelines the agrarian struggles and the agrarian agency at work in rural places and in agricultural places. So it's an intellectual blind spot not to focus on agrarian and see how plantation economies are the same political economies, financialization, speculation are happening in urban and how connected are these struggles are.
Just one last thing to add. You know, it's really fascinating and disturbing at this point in time, the way in which skyrocketing fertilizer prices, you mentioned Hormuz at the beginning, right, is really being very damaging to agriculture in India. And of course, you know, the farmers have been very much at the forefront of demanding, of, you know, fair prices and ensuring that they don't bottom out in terms of their own livelihoods. Right now, because of the high cost of inputs of fertilizers, that's going to have such ratcheting effects on the entire economy, and it's going to actually lead to more people being pushed out, especially marginal farmers being pushed out of agriculture if they cannot make ends meet, they cannot pay debts back, right? And so that deep connection of what's happening transnationally with oil prices, inputs to fertilizers, how that's affecting food production, farmers' livelihoods, right, in a very important agricultural region of the world, and then potentially leading to spin-off effects in urban areas. These are real through lines that are very important to recognize in any kind of conceptualization of geopolitical ecology.
Thanks. I was also thinking about earlier, Malini, you were talking about how critical geopolitics is different than IR, international relations. And Garrett, you talked about also racial capitalism feeding off binaries. So what do you see as the limitations of the mainstream geopolitical analysis that is kind of dominant at the moment? There's, of course, also newer approaches to talking about Second Cold War and some other sort of novel approaches. So I was kind of wondering, how does geopolitical ecology perhaps relate to some of these existing approaches, and how does it go beyond perhaps, and how does it unsettle some of these approaches as well?
I think I already mentioned that there are these tired tropes, and Garrett mentioned binaries that divide the world up, that is kind of the bread and butter of geopolitics. And that's, you know, it's deeply problematic, you know, these first versus third world, urban versus rural. But I think there's other common sense terminology that sits within geopolitics, such as failed states, right? And this notion of conflict-ridden region. And what this does is it locates causality within the local, right? Oh, as if somehow, you know, there's a state in Sudan that has just failed, you know, because it is backwards and it is uncivilized, right? Without understanding that the deep sort of colonial extractivism around minerals in the region, right? The role of European imperialism in fueling issues there that are continuing to have afterlives, et cetera. And you certainly get, and our listeners will certainly get the point I'm trying to make here about this really very problematic term of failed states. But even the notion of conflict-ridden region, right? There's this tendency to think about, oh, you know, the Middle East is too complicated. It's just a conflict-ridden region. Like Israel and Palestine have a long-standing conflict, right? And so there's this way in which geopolitics gets chalked up to a complicated conflict, which then again does a gross disservice to that root causal analysis that I think is so important in political ecology. I think even with the media, I think they're very complicit in these tired tropes of geopolitics and kind of reproduce that rather than questioning it.
All of this. There's a book, Why Nations Fail. And our response is like, why fail nations? Who benefits when you get right to sit back and give some another nation an F? And that you somehow are innocent in the fact that there was, you know, entire histories of colonialism, much less like ongoing extraction. There's definitely a power move in projecting underdeveloped, uncivilized, failed state, conflict-prone region. And because we're in a sector where this is reproducing itself, where power reproduces itself discursively, we see that when a young person who has very good intentions for peace, for, you know, well-being of the world, gets trained into a geopolitical imaginary that inscribes and enforces this idea that there are failed nations, there are successful nations, there are innocent nations, then they go out and they enact that on the world. So we're watching that happen. The other thing is just nation state as a dominant scale of reference. It's so recent. So it's such an ahistorical, such an apolitical, such an erasure of colonialism to kind of lock in the current modern day nation state borders. And it lends itself to militarizing those borders because those are kind of locked in on a geopolitical imaginary level and then get locked in, you know, literally with highly securitized borders. And then I'll also say it lends itself to kind of a big man versus big man, as if the entire diverse, gorgeous humanity of the world can be summarized with like one bad dude, Putin over here, and another bad dude, Trump. And then their, you know, shenanigans are somehow like we're all subsumed within that. It gives them more power. It lends itself to dictators taking the helm of, you know, there's such an ego to this big man politics that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that only kind of a psychopathic narcissism would want to take that role, you know? And so then we're stuck with this geopolitical imaginary that we're all kind of suffering in. There's so much more to say, but I think I'll pass the mic to that.
Thank you. So in the discussion we've been having so far, you've been moving across scales and space times from infrastructures and borders to agrarian struggles and planetary transformation. So I had a question regarding the methodology and conceptual freshness that also geopolitical ecology brings. So I wanted to maybe hear more about like how can geopolitical ecology help us think across these different spatial and temporal scales and perhaps the interconnections between them.
Going far beyond the nation state is so important for the project of geopolitical ecology. And if you think about movements for agrarian justice or movements around, as we are now seeing more and more against oligarchy or against forms of, you know, deepening inequality, even mineral resource grabs that we're seeing, right? I think these are all cross-border grassroots movements, they're coalitional. I think what international relations does, and I know that it's come a long way, is really start at that unit of analysis of the state, the nation state, right? And geopolitics does that as well, the study of geopolitics. Whereas geopolitical ecology might start from, you know, good old sort of, you know, ecologically rooted land-based analysis, right, of what really is going on the ground. And then work up from there to understanding power, of course, and across scales, across borders, across time. Historical analysis is very, very important, right? So I think really your methodological entry point is different, right? If all you're doing is reading speeches of strongmen or you're reading tweets of strongmen, right, or whatever, expos, and you're kind of thinking about great power rivalry through, like, you know, statements put out by federal governments or whatever, how are you getting at that, at really, you know, the people, you know, energies that come from the grassroots, right? And even historicizing some of the terms much more. And so methodologically, I think it's very important for geopolitical ecology to even turn to diverse languages to understand power, right? And this is one of the issues with academia, of course, is its over-reliance on English language, which I think has certain myopic outcomes, which is that you don't get that full spectrum of those who have historically been left out of the Anglophone sphere. So methodologically, even I think we made a pitch, you know, for that. And you know, in our Palestine work is really, there's so many accounts by Palestinian journalists, academics,
you know, students, farmers, union workers, right, that are describing the genocide in real time and this describing exactly what's going on. And I think that is one of the benefits of social media. You were seeing very, very kind of immediate ground level reports of this, right? How do we build narratives and even kind of an agenda for change based on those unlikely sources rather than relying on the sort of media industrial complex? So that's I think, an important way of decentering whose voice counts in the field of geopolitical ecology.
Yes. So again, everything Malini said, I will also say that there's a discourse analysis. What geopolitical ecology is a counter narrative, and it's saying that it's urgent to unpack the dominant discourses because they're kind of they're genocidal in impact. And that seemed like a very bold statement to make a few years ago, you know, as we were kind of saying, and we didn't use the word genocide in the 2023 paper until deeper into 2023, when the Israeli forces and the deliberate starvation of Palestine became so evident. And we had so many ground reports, so many Amnesty International, United Nations reports, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Oxfam, and these on the ground reports saying it's deliberate. The food's in the truck. It's blocked. The children are dying with the food meters away. This is not a humanitarian crisis. This is not just a sad thing. And to watch the international liberal order unable to enact, you know, an accountability, all of a sudden the urgency of why wasn't there accountability for that? What about all of the well-meaning human rights organizations? What about the entire sector that does food security? Famine was declared and the food was right there. So the urgency of unpacking the words that are deflecting accountability becomes very important, because if there's no accountability for Gaza, guess what? There's not going to be any for Lebanon and West Bank and Iran and Yemen. Like it's going to keep going unless there's accountability. And Cuba, you know, and Venezuela. So the urgency is in watching the dominant framework unable to, even on its own terms, provide for food for children, you know, and the basic, you know, kind of liberal goals.
Yeah, picking up on that, Garrett, I really enjoyed the final section in your editorial on geopolitical agroecology, where you talk about or introduce a more reparative and hopeful horizon. So could you perhaps elaborate on what geopolitical agroecology means, both analytically and politically, and what kind of alternative socio-ecological and geopolitical futures does it open up?
Yes, thank you for that so much, Nathan. I appreciate it. And I'll say, you know, we as scholars, I feel like our work is to unpack the terms that are doing so much damage, you know, because we're in the belly of the beast, we're in the heart of where they're reproducing itself. But we are learning from global movements which have been doing the work of connecting struggles for generations. So the agroecology movement in the world with the food sovereignty movement and the anti-colonial movement are so brilliant analytically and doing such amazing political analysis. I'm thinking of Via Campesina. I'm thinking of, you know, the various kind of seed networks, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and then later the UN Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and others working in rural areas. Those are examples of international and transnational coalitions of place-based anti-colonial analysis already happening. And so I think our job is to say, look at how this incredible set of movements is intellectually sidelined in academia and in dominant geopolitical imaginaries and in dominant geopolitical analysis, much less in like dominant power. So our work is to kind of connect the extraordinary grassroots movements that are already happening, that are very transnational already and very politically conscious, and know the whole time it's a land grab. I think the irony is that for us, it's like revelatory. And for them, they're like, our land was captured. We know it's all a water grab, you know. So our job is to kind of take the knowledge that's already been happening in the movements around the world and bring those to places of power.
Malini, did you want to add something to that, though?
No, I think that's very powerful, is this notion that academic theory often comes limping behind what's actually going on the ground in terms of social movements and in terms of these sort of liberatory spaces and even narratives, right? There's a way in which even academic discourse is behind grassroots narratives and even histories of grassroots movements. So again, flipping the the focus to learn from different constituents who we need to also think of as experts. I think one of the problems with academia is to really have this sort of obsession with expertise really emanating in these very, very prominent, you know, public and private institutions, rather than experts being those who are closest to the land, right? Those who are actually witnessing ecocide and the kind of depletion of soils and the depletion of water resources, et cetera. And that's where political ecology has always been very powerful, right? Is to really, it's like a analysis of land-based attachments, movements, right? Human experiences. Certainly water, of course, is part of that. But I think I'm really talking about resource being so at the center. So there's that part about too. So it's almost like it's an agenda to both problematize hegemonic narratives and to follow the footsteps of people who are closer to the land in trying to understand power at this larger scale. To understand power, you don't necessarily have to work at the levels of the state and the nation state. You actually have to work at the level of those who are experiencing that power firsthand in their everyday lives, and not take as gospel truth, right, the narratives of hegemonic groups. And so that's part of the agenda, I think, too, in terms of ethics and methodology.
Thank you. Thanks, Mandini. So I wanted to maybe enter into a final question that I had. You talked about your forthcoming paper, which sounds really interesting, and I would love to read it. I wanted to also ask if you're developing a book on geopolitical ecology, because I think it would be a very useful and timely book. I'm really interested in, because I would like to use geopolitical ecology in my research, and I'm sure a lot of listeners would also like to use it. So I wanted to check as to what kind of research agendas, political practices, and intellectual collaboration that the framework of geopolitical ecology might enable moving forward.
Well, I can talk just briefly about our paper, and then maybe Garrett can explain some of the directions we're hoping to chart around this field. And very collaborative, and you know, in the best case scenario, it would be a transnational endeavor, right? And not just located in a single university or just only among academics. But our paper that is under review, and we've submitted revisions as well at Political Geography, is titled Food as Necropolitics: The Starvation of Palestinian Sovereignty and the Stakes of Geopolitical Ecology. It's for a special issue on geopolitical ecology. We very much get at this issue that Garrett was bringing up earlier, is why has the liberal international order seemed to have so spectacularly failed to avert this acute forced starvation to the point where we did reach level 5 of the famine barometer. And one of the very raison d'etre of the liberal order post-World War II was to avert this kind of massive humanitarian catastrophe, right? By, you know, states signing on to sort of basic humanitarian principles of cooperation and multilateralism, right? And so in some ways, you know, we almost asked this question, this historical question, that many have been asking, Gaza reveals the failure of the liberal system, right? The liberal order. And it's sort of failed on its own terms. And does it live? And, you know, is it the failure, or is it the perhaps that the system was never intended to actually work, you know, for those who are considered the most devalued and dispossessed of the earth, right? The wretched of the earth, as Fanon would call it, was the liberal order never really designed to protect them, because it is, in fact, a long shadow of imperialism by the very architects, right? And they're descendants of the architects that created the colonial order. So we ask very provocative questions in that piece, but we essentially put at the heart these stories, the empirics, the endless. I mean, it is a data bomb, that article, because we've drawn so many different human rights articles and humanitarian reports to really painstaking and potentially even like disturbing way the myriad ways of food-related atrocities. You know, from the sort of bombing of those who were going to seek flour when they were hungry, right, to the atrocious Gaza Humanitarian Fund, where literally Médecins Sans Frontières said this is orchestrated killing. You know, so how does even food and humanitarianism serve as a vehicle of death dealing? It's no coincidence that they were targeting agricultural workers and farmers and foodways, and the land now is untillable. right? So again, like, even though, you know, the Green Revolution and all this, like, advancement in addressing famine, right? You know, colonial famine was behind us, right? Starts the whole Bretton Woods institutions kind of thing, where, you know, we have to sort of cooperate to lift people out of poverty, because never again do we want the kind of fascism that we saw in Europe's Nazism, right? And what happens then, right, is that you see this kind of pattern of genocide then repeating, right, in the 21st century. And of course, there are other very atrocious things that have happened in terms of forced starvation. The paper is really, you know, about how that liberal order has failed and how food has become this sort of necropolitical tool. That is to say, and sorry for not defining this earlier, right, it comes from the term necro, which literally means death. And Achille Mbembe has theorized the politics of death dealing, as opposed to biopolitics, of what Foucault talked about, the politics of maintaining and reproducing life, right, which was also a 19th century start onwards, 18th century kind of project of liberal government, really that the necropolitical lived on through colonialism. And we're seeing it not just lived on through European colonialism as having a particular end date, but has continues reverberations in today's political world order.
Nitin, thank you so much for that great question. I have been working with agroecologists in Cuba and learning from agroecologists in Cuba. I've had the honor of working with them and learning from them for about a decade and a half. And so I have been writing and have paper under review about U.S.-Cuba geopolitics as a land grab and as agricultural and the weaponization of hunger, which was the entire blockade for all of these years, and the tightening of it most recently, so that there's active food insecurity on an island that's very well educated and very committed to everybody on the island not going hungry. So this is a strangulation of the Cuban economy. But the failure of dominant policy and often academia, who says, like, oh, this is an ideology, this is communist versus capitalism. At the end of the day, Marco Rubio is funded by the Fanjul Brothers, the, you know, sugar barons. You know, they want Cuba for another Puerto Rico, you know, in the neo-colony. So this is an agribusiness capture, just like it always was, you know. So the ahistorical dimension of Cuba was a plantation, you know, it was a banana republic all those years until the revolution, which was not communist at first. It was actually agrarian uprising, Cuban, Afro-Cuban, Black, you know, agrarian, many female leaders. And then, you know, Fidel got the glory, but the erasure of agrarian power is everywhere. I'm thinking about Cuba as a classic case of getting distracted by heads of state when in fact it's a land grab and food is the weapon. But also I think it's urgent for us, particularly in the US-based, you know, institutions, to talk about the extreme funding of military. Trillions of dollars, Nitin. I mean, it's unbelievable how much the Iran attacks on Iran are costing. Like, the entire government public funds are being plundered by military contractors right now. And AI and big tech, you know, which has this kind of fascistic, crazy, really eugenic origin story, you know, some of the big billionaire tech bros. So it is urgent for us to call out the extreme militarization and the extreme capture of water through data centers, and point to how the terms geopolitics get used to justify everything. But in fact, it's just a capture of water and of land for our generations, for people on the front line of these iniquities, and for future generations. So there's, like, so many ways to apply it. That's actually the tragic part of it, is that it's so relevant.
Thanks, Kat. That's a wonderful note to end on. I think, so I really learned a lot today, and I feel just calling it geopolitical ecology also is so powerful in itself. But the way you unpacked it for our listeners today was so, so powerful. Thanks for being so generous and sharing on this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'd love to stay in contact, Nitin, with you and those you're working with.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.